Welcome to Map Hackers, the GIS podcast where we break down industry buzzwords into information you can use. It's been a while since our last episode. Happy to get everybody back together right before the Esri UC, and we have a very special guest today. But first, let's meet who joined us on the panel today. We have the one and only Catherine Smythe.
Thanks, Matt. Hi, I'm Catherine. I'm a former shovel bum, aka archaeologist by trade, and now I'm here and making maps. And man, I don't make pretty ones, so I'm really excited about our special guest because I have a lot of questions. Adam Pfister, what do you have to say?
Yeah, hi, I'm Adam. I love looking at stuff on maps and always want to get better at making them. So also really pumped. Mike?
Yeah, hi everyone. It's Mike, aka Drone to Mike, and I am excited to chat about maps and visualization. And particularly, I'm interested in 3D visualization. I know that's an up-and-coming topic and can't wait to chat about it. Kira?
Everyone, my name's Kira Morish. I have a background in landscape architecture and art, so I'm always interested in learning how to make better maps.
And our special guest, I'll let him introduce himself.
I'm still blown away by the drone to mic reference. That's high praise, Mike. Nice intro. You get 3.5 stars for that one. 3.5 out of 4. My name is John Nelson. I work with all you all here at Esri, you wonderful colleagues. And I just learned Catherine is a previous archaeologist. That's great. Anyways, enough about you. Let's talk about me. So John Nelson, I work on the Living Atlas team. Living Atlas team. The Living Atlas is a little bit like Wikipedia for maps and data. People can contribute to it, and Living Atlas will host it, and Esri will put data in Living Atlas, that sort of thing. It's great. I love it. And I make wild and crazy maps and learning resources for how to make those maps, and I'm generally stealing a living and loving it. So thanks for having me on today to talk about data.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome, John. We're excited to have you. You may recognize John from some things like the cartography MOOC. It's pretty famous. He knows Ken Field by name, and I think he has his personal phone number, so that's cool.
He keeps having it changed. Let's talk about today's. Every now and then I'll get his phone number, but just as soon as I get it, it's changed. Apparently, it's part of one of the conditions of my probation. I'm told.
Probation. Well, sounds like a conversation for you and your lawyer, but let's get to today's buzzword. All right, so today's buzzword is data visualization. So data visualization is a hot topic with many companies, including our own, getting in on the action. And the simplest explanation that I found online was data visualization is the graphic representation of data and information. All right, that makes sense. But it's pretty boring. It doesn't really give us a whole lot to go on. So I think a good place to start is, why would we even want to visualize data? Why isn't a table not good enough?
Yeah. Well, actually, a table is data visualization. I heard Edward Tufte, DataViz thinker and speaker out there. He said that if you've got less than 20 numbers, oftentimes you're better off just showing a little table. And that's the best data viz out there for a small number number of numbers. And he's right. Oh, my goodness. Sometimes I've seen visualizations, sometimes maps, that are really forced. And there's this visual construct that doesn't need to happen. I just want to see the numbers. You know what I mean? Because a visualization inherently encodes things and kind of puts those numbers into little physical parameters that you then have to sort of decode into a sense of magnitude, more or less, up, down, that kind of thing. And oftentimes just the numbers are plenty. But when you get over 20 numbers or, you know, thereabouts, starts making a lot more sense to look at like a metaphorical representation of that magnitude or the trend or trajectory, that sort of thing. So at this point, I've already forgotten what the question was, Matt, because I just started talking about numbers and tables, and I just meandered.
No. And, hold on. You just went deep immediately, and we love it. We love it. That's what we're here for. No, I don't care about the original question. I'm totally interjecting here because you're on a roll with this data. Now, I've heard this question before, and I'm not ever sure really how to handle this. You know, we're a mapping company, so in my mind, I put everything on a map. But you just answered when you may not put something on a map. How do you know where the threshold is?
Sure. Yeah, I love maps, and I love making maps, and I love showing people how to make maps. But oftentimes, a map is not the right answer. And I say often, more like, you know, sometimes, occasionally a map is not the right answer. Because sometimes putting it into, you know, a geographic construct can kind of obscure some of the message, or even reverse the inherent message that the data is you know, trying to show. Because there are a lot of issues with mapping that have to be overcome. Like if you're mapping to political zones, like countries or counties, they're really different in size and highly different in population. So you have to be really careful as a map person how to show that, but also when to use it. Sometimes we're better off not making a map. And I love maps so much that it would hurt my feelings to make a map where the map was kind of hurting the message a little bit. I've got an anecdote. If anyone wants to hear
an anecdote
about that. Yeah.
Yes.
So some years ago, I was curious, it was an Olympic year, and I was thinking, like, which countries are just flush with gold medal glory, and which countries, you know, just never seem to win a medal, even though maybe there's just loads of people in that country. What's the deal? And it's interesting to see total medal counts for countries, but really it's just the usual suspects up there with their, you know, big medal counts. But a lot of those countries have a lot of people. And so it's not totally a fair comparison when you think about these smaller countries that have, you know, less than a million population, but they're winning medals. That's really interesting to me. So you've got a higher proportion of medal winners. And I had this data and I normalized it by population, as all good geographers ought. And I was looking at it and it was still really problematic because these small countries were really blown away by, you know, the big ones like Canada and, you know, Russia were eclipsing all the good stuff. And I thought, wait a second, why am I forcing this into a map? And so really I just did a table and I listed out the countries as rows and I did the columns as the Olympic years. And then each cell was the proportion of their population that had won a medal, just to that extent, you know, like Olympic glory per capita. And I just color coded them. It was just a pivot table in Excel. And it turned out to be so much more insightful than kind of digging around across like many, many maps. You know, you'd have to have one map for each Olympic Games. And this was just way more compact and efficient. And you could engage the data more directly. So anyways, that's my anecdote. I spent 5 minutes talking about why you shouldn't make maps, but really maps are great. I still love you, maps.
I got a question about, so I emailed you, you should remember this, John. It was like 2.5 years ago and it was an email. You should remember this. But I was searching, asking.
I'm quickly typing. Adam it was, Pfister from,
yeah.
Sent, Adam Pfister.
All in trash. So I'd seen something you'd done about that. You took the UN happiness report. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was you. And
yeah.
This kind of takes on from what we were just talking about, like when to map something, how much of it do you have to map? Why should you map it? Mm-hmm. And this was, I thought, a really well done example of how to take a lot of information and visually assign it to all the countries in the world and not have it get lost when someone looks at it. You know, there's still a lot going on because within that happiness report, there's 6 or 7 categories of how happy are you within that category, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you had a chance, kind of since you've done that, to reflect on that process and if you would have done it a different way, if you would have tried your Olympic glory per capita sort of thing on that as well, or mm-hmm. what your thoughts are on that process too.
Yeah, that's such a cool study that they do, by the way. The UN does a happiness index. And just for some context, I'll throw out like a little description. They send out a survey all over the world to some meaningful statistical number within a population, and they say, hey, how good is your life? If you can imagine a ladder with 10 rungs on it, how far up that ladder are you of happiness? How far up or how far down are you? And then they just collect that's all they collect, which I think is pretty interesting. And then they do a statistical bit of magic on it with known data. So they know the per capita income. They, you know, they have surveys of trust in government. They have measures of people's familial relationships with other people, like their dependency on other people. They've got all this great data, and then they just use this to see how much of that is perhaps influenced by it based on all these countries. It's really fascinating. And they do it every year, which is like another dimension of fascinating, because mm-hmm. it's not just this one-time thing where like, oh, it turns out Denmark's really happy. By the way, Denmark is really happy because they've figured out how to have really low expectations. No joke. They have really low expectations. And so they come out on top all the time.
How many people respond to these things?
I don't remember, but it's the UN. So they've got some kind of, you know, they've got some statisticians in there checking things and saying, yeah, this is the representative of the country. But yeah, and I wrestled with making a map of that for a few years. Like, I think the third year that I was aware of it, that they released that data, Adam, I was like, okay, darn it, for crying out loud, I'm going to make a map this time. Because I had failed the previous two times for that same reason that the Olympic medal counts data was problematic in a map. Because I wanted it to be fair. I didn't want like a small country just to be this tiny little blip of color, and color has its mm-hmm. own issues. And so I was happy with this kind of scaled, like a bubble map. People will call it a bubble map or graduated symbol map for one of the variables, like, you know, per capita income, let's say. You've got bigger bubbles over here and smaller bubbles over there. And there's interesting regional trends. So I knew I wanted it on a map. If there's an interesting spatial component, then a map is your friend for mm-hmm. real. There's no way around it. And so I knew I wanted to map it, but there were six variables, maybe mm-hmm. six variables. Six, yeah. And I was like, how do I do this? You know, I could have six separate maps, but then, you know, people are having to like flip around and look at them and compare them. And I thought, well, wait a second, why don't I just have six versions of this bubble map, and I'll just offset the bubbles around like this little six-sided point. And so it was this weird little symbol, like a flower kind of, with each little circle was graduated, and it was staggered in like a little, you know, a multi-part symbol, that kind of thing, if you could imagine something like that. And it worked out pretty well. I was happy with it. You could get an overall sense by looking, kind of fuzzing your eyes and seeing like where is a lot of things really big. And then you could focus on like blue, which I think was trust in government or something, and then see the trend. You know, if you just told your brain to focus on blue, the blue circles for a second, you could make a regional comparison there. That was fun. Mm-hmm. So that was an example of kind of pushing through a typical way of mapping, because there wasn't really a good typical way of mapping that. We had to come up with something kind of novel to get there.
It's fascinating. Hey, John, I actually have a couple of questions or topics, and one of them you and I kind of worked on somewhat lately, as you posted to your YouTube the turn a ton of data into hexagon map. I'll plug John if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
YouTube and check it out. But one of the things that we had talked about was, how do you map a ton of data? How do you map plus 500,000 records or more?
Yeah.
And so I guess that kind of tailors into, when we chat about it, it was, how do we actually go about planning a visualization in terms of that?
Right.
Like, how do you collectively say, okay, and you kind of hinted a little bit to it in the previous topic, but how do you say, okay, here's a whole bunch of data. What is the best way to visualize that? And I think it starts to move away from just, do we need a table or do we need a map that's visualized, as you mentioned? And it starts to move into, well, how do we actually visualize this? What is the way to visualize this?
Yeah, for
sure. What do you think that kind of top three steps are for planning your visualization with larger data sets.
There are strategies for mapping massive data sets. And my official formal answer is it depends. Like everything else, of course, it depends. And it depends on what you're mapping. So, for example, many years ago, I was making a map of tornadoes. And this was a really big data set of every tornado recorded since 1950, its location, its touchdown, its, you know, takeoff point, and all kinds of information. And I was aggregating it because that's what they tell you to do. If you have a ton of data, well, you start grouping it into these geographic areas so you can color code it and make a visual comparison, like counties. I was dropping them into counties and then color coding counties based on tornado count historically. And then you get into issues. Well, some counties are bigger than others, of course. And so you have like a per square mile tornado incidence rate per, and you start getting more and more abstract. And I was like, well, also, tornadoes don't care about counties. So why should my map even use counties? So aggregation is a strategy. But in that case, I said, well, wait a second, screw it. I'm just going to show all the tornadoes all at once, kitchen sink style. And I happened to make them glow, which looked a lot of fun. And you immediately got a sense for where there's more, where there's less. The mountainous areas were like this tornado no-go zone that I wouldn't have expected otherwise. It wouldn't have manifested as well and clearly as if I had aggregated them into counties. When you just show the data and there's a ton of data, you start getting this weird kind of cloud intel where there's just so many particles that they start forming a really beautiful structure, and you can get something out of that structure. So one option is to not aggregate, just lob it all onto the map and see what happens. And if it's just a mess still, and some cases it's not what you want to do, for example, traffic fatality data. So traffic fatality data, there's a lot of it, unfortunately, but a lot of it is heavily overlapping. And if you just have a lot of points overlapping, I wouldn't necessarily know if there was 5 traffic fatalities at this intersection or 500. You know, there's no way of knowing. And that's a real disservice to that data, especially considering the topic of that data. And so in that case, what you can do is to aggregate. And I thought, do I aggregate these into counties, political areas? That would be a viable solution, but I wanted something a little bit smaller and finer resolution so I could actually track highways and expressways in locales. And so I created a hexagon zone, a hexagonal mesh, just like an archaeologist would do. Catherine, when you would go to, you know, shuffle bum is a new term to me, but it made me giggle a little bit. When you go to a site, you'd create a grid, right? And you map the grid. Every grid cell has a name, and you dig up what's in there, and then you record it. And so you're creating a square tessellation. And so what I did was just create a hexagonal tessellation, because hexagons are, I don't know, they're like 50% cooler than squares. And and so I then just aggregated everything into those. And you can color code it. You can scale a hexagon shape based on the number. You can color code it based on the proportion, perhaps, of like traffic fatalities that included alcohol or sleepiness and something like that. You can really do some interesting and useful things and have some concrete numbers to take away, like at this zone within this polygon that you can see there were this many incidents and this proportion was alcohol related and this proportion was sleepiness. So sometimes aggregation is great. And the example you're using was airplane data. Beautiful. What was the source of that? Who provided that to you?
It was FlightAware.
FlightAware. Yeah, that's right. And it was so dense that when I looked at the map, it was just a solid yellow square of the region, because all the lines covered everything up. And then, you know, I remember zooming into Chicago O'Hare, and you can start seeing some resolution for the flights themselves, but it wasn't visually useful at that point. Another strategy that I tried then was to make every line 99% transparent. And then I zoomed out, and you kind of get this glowy heat map of where the dense flight paths are. So that's another option.
Starts to show trend. Too,
yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, we all know that aircraft have trends, right? They're required to fly in very specific corridors and things. And being able to do that and use a very purposeful visualization allowed us to expose trend and make sure that in this case, aircraft actually are aligning to the standards that are set before them. So fascinating. Yeah, it was fascinating.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for sending that data over. And I ended up, I did both. For one instance, I did really semi-transparent lines, and you could see like these trunk lines of transportation, and then the kind of minor flight paths were more faint, which is a nice natural representation of that. But then I did the thing where I chunked them all into hexagons. And once they're in hexagons, you can, you know, click on a hexagon and say, this many flights went overhead in this time period. And that's right. Interesting. You couldn't do that with just transparency. So one of them is highly visual, and one of them gives you nice reporting capabilities. And alongside reporting capabilities, I did weird stuff, like kind of turn that hexagon surface into a 3D surface. So it kind of looked like a 3D pincushion. And so the satellite imagery of the ground was either higher or lower based on how many flights happened overhead. And is it all that useful? Not that instance, but it was fun. And I think something like that would attract eyeballs. People walking by that map go, oh, that's kind of an interesting map. What's that? And they stop and they're taking a second closer look, which is really valuable in data viz because there's so much out there. People can just kind of easily forget something or ignore something. But if you can get somebody's attention through interesting design, then you're miles ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point, and something that I struggle with is telling the facts, right? Here's the data that we have. I want to show it, but also the visualization needs to be compelling enough that someone's going to stop and take a second look and really understand the story that I'm trying to tell with the data. And I just want to get a plus one vote for using transparency and multiple layers over that. One of my favorite techniques. It looks cool no matter what data set you're using. So I can highly recommend that one. There was an example of Vietnam bombing campaigns, which is a really,
Cooper
cool
Thomas.
Example.
Yeah, Cooper Thomas made that map. Yeah, great work.
And that one's really excellent. So definitely steal that technique.
And you know, he did both.
A lot.
He did both. He did one using transparency, and then he did a smaller map aggregating things into hexagons because each one gave a different little bit of insight. And why not just have both in your map layout, which was a nice move on his. So I think of this morning I was picking raspberries with my kids. This is mega raspberry time of the year here in Michigan. And I think of this every year when I'm picking raspberries, I tend to think about data a lot. And I'll stand in one spot and there's just this host of raspberries and I'll pick them. And they're all gone. I've harvested the whole reachable area from where I'm standing, right? And then I find that if I just take a half a step to the side, all of a sudden there's a million more raspberries. Just because I've taken a step to the side, there's a ton more raspberries that I can get. It's just because I changed my perspective slightly. And you mentioned, facts and the truth, Matthew. DataViz is really interesting and important in that there's not like one single fact to take out of data. There's not like a truth that can be extracted from it. It's a perspective and a point of view. And it depends on what starts manifesting itself. So one DataViz, you know, will give you a lot of little nuggets and insights. But if you take a little half step, another sort of DataViz seen from a slightly different angle will give you more. And, you know, that first batch of raspberries wasn't a lie or false, and the second batch wasn't, you know, the only true raspberries. They're both right. They're both good. You're just getting a little bit of a different perspective on the same data and getting more understanding and stuffing your face with more raspberries, which is my goal.
I'd like to say on behalf of all of us before we wrap up that that's, I think, a perfect embodiment of why we appreciate you as well on our team, you know? You provide
my
that
sassy raspberry references.
Yeah, because of your different perspective. You know, that's the key to innovation, I think, right? Just changing perspective even minutely.
Yeah, so there's no one way to make a map, and that's a mark Mark Harrower quote. He said that one time. There's no one right way to make a map. And oftentimes we get a little bit nervous and stressed out. I think students would feel this way. I used to feel this way. Oh, I've got this data. There's one right way to make it. I hope I don't screw it up. Mm-hmm. Right. But whatever method you bring to visualizing that data is going to reveal some insight. And somebody else might do it a different way, and they're revealing different insights, and they're both really interesting and valid. And once we kind of grab onto that, it makes us feel more comfortable to try new things and goof around and experiment. And that's where the neat stuff starts happening.
I'm definitely going to take that time to experiment and just try something new. I know as solution engineers, we're always like, we have a strict deadline. I need to get this done. But at the same time, it's definitely worthwhile taking a little break, seeing what the data does, do a little exploratory analysis on it, change the colors, man. Make it 3D and see how it plays out. An example where it didn't play out, I was preparing for a presentation. I really wanted to do something in 3D, and I was so focused on that. And I made this scene, and I put it into 3D, and it looked really cool. And then I showed everybody, and they're like, so, but what does it mean? Like, what doesn't really mean anything? It's just like, it's 3D. That's what it means. Like, no, scrap it, put it in a table, and then make, oh, yeah, okay, the table makes way more sense. So, so pick the right visualization, but don't be afraid to experiment is my sign off there.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You won't hear any argument from me. Leave yourself time to experiment, because it's easy for me to get into a rut where I'll do something and then the next bit of data I get has to be done the same way, and my knee-jerk reaction. And the flip side of that is sometimes you want to do the 3D visualization like you're describing, and it just didn't work out for that data. But you had some guts and you tried it out, and the next bit of data that falls in your lap turns out maybe seeing it in that third dimension is going to reveal something interesting and worthwhile. And so it's that experimentation that gives you a toolkit of options that you can kind of reach down and pull out. And the more you experiment, the more confident you'll be in trying different things, the more grace you'll have for colleagues who are trying different things, or maybe, you know, don't hit it out of the park every time, but you know, you'll get it next time on the next data set. So I think it makes you a more well-rounded and capable map maker when you give yourself time to try out weird stuff.
Empathy and map making, I like it.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's what it is. Because every map is a little bit of you poured into this visual thing. And people say, oh, it's nothing's personal, it's just business. But everything you make, that's the time that you have on this earth. And you poured yourself into that, and you directed your energy towards something and put it out there. And you're doing that because you can't stand there and have a 2-hour-long conversation with each person in the audience about this phenomenon. What you're doing is putting yourself into a visual and just setting it free into the world and hoping whoever sees it gets some amount of that out of it. So it's all empathy. You're always trying to think about, you know, what are they going to get out of this? What's the best, clearest way that I can communicate this to them? Can I make this fun and interesting and engaging so they want to learn more about it? Yeah. Map making is just empathy with shapes.
there's our new team tattoo. Empathy with shapes.
I think that's it.
Also, that could be our new band name, which I like. Good band name.
Empathy with shapes.
Yeah, so we have a few more minutes left. I want to just wrap up here with some final thoughts. We discussed a lot about data visualization and a lot about raspberries as well. But I think my main takeaways, and people can weigh in, my first main takeaway is don't be afraid to experiment. Also have empathy for when you're giving feedback or looking at someone else's data visualizations, as you know, John's alluded to. Someone, it's unlikely to just like threw some stuff on a map, like, here you go. I mean, you think about it, you spend a lot of time on it. So understand that that's what somebody else did. It may not be what you like, but you know, have empathy for that visualization. And the last takeaway that I am going to use all the time is a table is visualization. So when someone tells me, you need to make a map of it, I'll be like, well, John says I don't have to. So I'll just like,
how many numbers are there?
Yeah. How many numbers are there? Yeah, exactly. Less than 20. Go ahead and make a table. Table it up. pass the mic over.
I think my biggest takeaway was kind of what John said, right? To that point of looking at somebody else's work or trying to understand why visualization was one way or another. And maybe it's just a matter of perspective, right? If you think about it from their perspective, maybe the visualization makes more sense than it does for you. And putting that into my own cartography, I think also is a way that will help me improve my cartography as I build maps, apps, and work with data. So thanks, John.
Yeah, you won't be thankful when you see my bill.
Just send it to Matt.
Yeah. Done.
Note to self, get sponsors. any last closing thoughts from the panel and John?
My closing thought is I'm grateful to be able to chat with you all, and it's fun nerding out on data and maps together. So I always enjoy this kind of thing.
Will you come back, John?
No, never. This is it. One and done. Sorry.
All right.
Nice.
Anyway, I do want to send a thank you to John for joining us today. It was fun. It's always nice to see your face and hear your voice, man. Also, thank you for the panel. Your insights were very valuable. And so I want everyone who's listening to go out there, try some data visualization techniques. Don't be afraid you can't get it wrong. Just try something new. That would be our one takeaway goal for this podcast, is everybody goes out there and does one new thing with data visualization, and then we've done our jobs. So on behalf of the Map Hackers, I hope everyone has a great week ahead, and stay mappy, everyone.